Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney. Your host will be traveling about battle space of the war for the free world, focusing in on the problems that we're facing at the moment from what I think of as Sharia. And there are few people who understand this better than our guests this hour, starting with a greatly admired friend and colleague, Nina Shea, who runs the Center for Religious Freedom at the Hudson Institute and has been an exemplary commissioner on the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. And we'll talk about her work in the latter capacity in a moment. But first off, Nina, I'm so grateful to have you in what I know is a busy holiday season to talk a little bit about the phenomenon of those who are seeking to impose Sharia. Let's start with Egypt, perhaps, because there's a case in point here. Your thoughts on the nature of the Muslim Brotherhood, now at the cusp of coming to power there, for women, for religious minorities, and for that matter, the Egyptian people and the region.
Yeah, well, great, Frank, to be with you. I'm always happy to join you because you have such interesting, penetrating takes on world events and domestic events. The Muslim Brotherhood is not being open or honest about what its platform is or what its program is, other than to promote Islam. We know that. The details of that we don't know, but we can assume that at its heart will be, or at its core, will be restrictions and punishments for dissent against Islam. And since Islam claims to dictate behavior and thinking and views on a wide range of life, whether it's politics or personal behavior, social and cultural, or even scientific issues, financial issues, we can assume there are going to be broad speech restrictions under the Muslim Brotherhood. And
this sort of Sharia blasphemy idea.
Blasphemy and apostasy. So expression will be very tightly watched, monitored, controlled, and regulated by the state. And so the people, you're right, the first line of victims are going to be the women, the religious minorities, the religious dissidents, the political reformers, innovators, anyone who is not on the same page ideologically as the Muslim Brotherhood. There won't be debate or critique permitted.
Right. You've written about this, Nina Shea, in your marvelous new book with Paul Marshall, Silenced: How Apostasy and Blasphemy Codes Are Choking Freedom Worldwide. One of the ways in which this is most egregiously being manifested, I guess one might say, is at the moment the sort of leading edge of mistreatment of women. It's captured in a sort of symbolic way by the brutalization of this woman, this girl, as they're calling her, in a blue bra. How does the misogynistic attitude of women play into this larger effort to force everyone to submit to this program?
Yeah, well, this is a cultural stagnation. We haven't, the culture, the Egyptian people have not had this debate about freedom, about freedom to dissent and freedom to reject Orthodox Islam. So the conscripts in the military are abusing these dissenters, dragging and kicking women, stripping them, a veiled woman. It horrified a large portion of the female community, and some of them were out in the streets protesting. The men's reaction, from what I've seen in the paper, was appalling. It was simply, she should have had more and more clothes under her abaya. She shouldn't have been out there. What was she doing out there in the first place protesting?
Blame the victim.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, it's a very big problem, and it's a circular problem, because if you shut down speech, you can't even debate it. And we have to break through that. Our pro-democracy movement in the United States is largely supported by the U.S. government through the National Endowment of Democracy, IRI, and Democratic Party Institute, and so forth, are very good about teaching process and very weak about imparting values and the essential freedoms that underpin democracy, freedoms of religion and expression. And that's what the United States must start exporting.
In a way, that's a function of focusing on, as you say, the mechanics of it, getting votes, getting elections, but not building the institutions that assure it's more than one man, one vote, one time. Nina Shea, let me ask you to tie into what you've just said about sort of the trajectory the Muslim Brotherhood and its ilk would have us on, not only elsewhere, but here as well, in the context of something I know you attended part of and have reported on, namely the Organization of the Islamic Cooperation, OIC,
right, the
meetings
OIC.
With the State Department last week.
Yes, the OIC is an organization of 56 member states, and their platform or their goal is to have worldwide punishments for Islamic blasphemy. That's actually in their action plan and charter. Yeah. They issue fatwas against apostasy, calling for punishments for apostasy from Islam. So this is a very illiberal organization, and it's shameful that our State Department is partnering with them on all issues, religious tolerance or intolerance. And that's exactly what happened last week when, as a result of Secretary Clinton's announcement in Istanbul, she co-chaired an OIC conference, a high-level meeting on religious intolerance. And by the way, these are the members of the OIC are some of the most religiously repressive governments in the entire world. It's Saudi Arabia, Iran.
Profoundly intolerant,
Pakistan,
right?
Yeah, and so the State Department held this conference with the OIC and did breastfeeding about how intolerant the American people were, but how fortunate we are to have the Obama administration having the Justice Department that is, quote, the conscience of the nation. What was laid out for the audience by the U.S. State Department and the Justice Department and the Obama officials was that we are intolerant people and have been against all religious minorities and now including Muslims, and that we have much to learn from them, that we are trying to prosecute the American people or American persons who are Islamophobic, who vandalize mosques and who oppose mosques. We could certainly learn from them. And they're saying this to an audience that included Saudi Arabia and some of the others.
It makes the head reel. And you wrote about this really brilliantly, I thought, in the New York Post last week in a column headlined, "A Perverse Process, Hillary's Free Speech Follies." And I guess the question that occurs out of all of this, Nina Shea of the Hudson Institute, is, are we failing to fundamentally understand the nature of the enemy, and therefore blinding ourselves to the threat that they pose and preventing ourselves from having a hope of countering them? And I'd ask you if you would tie that into your experience with the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom and what's happened to it as sort of symptomatic of our failures in this respect.
Yeah, well, we have failed to understand this. We are shutting down debate among ourselves about this under the, cooperating with this program of stamping out Islamophobia, considered Islamophobic to debate or critique Islam. And it's considered shameful, although it's legal here, unlike, say, a place like Austria or France. And we're worse than that. I think we're feeding into the propaganda of the likes of Saudi Arabia and Iran by saying that we're just as bad as they are, making these moral equivalencies. Now, the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom is an independent federal agency, a watchdog, if you will, of the State Department, created by Congress, about 12 years ago, and it has been a bold, clear voice within the U.S. government talking about the religious cleansing and total zero tolerance for non-Muslims, Christians, Jews, Baha'is, Ahmadiyyas, Yazidis, Mandeans, other religious minorities in
even non-Sharia adherent Muslims as well. You've done marvelous work there. And Nina, we have to let you go, I'm afraid. But thank you for your service at the commission and for the continuing work you're doing at the Hudson Institute. It is indispensable. And I urge people to support the work specifically of the Center for Religious Freedom, which you direct. Keep it up, please. And come back to us again soon. This is a vital concern to us.
We'll be talking
about more in the course of the rest of the program. Next up, Ned May will tell us about how this is playing out in Europe and what it will mean for us here. Straight ahead.
I was able to lose the 80 pounds I gained due to pregnancy. It was pretty easy to eat whatever I wanted and not think about it.
The Meta System from Judy Singer has been helping make weight loss easier for a quarter century.
My husband's grandmother used it 20 years ago to lose weight for a wedding and said it was the only way to go.
The Meta System also has an excellent support staff.
They were very supportive. The first time that I ordered the product, they called me and suggested that I order a lower dosage to begin with. They didn't want me to jump the gun right off the bat, and it was nice to know that they actually cared.
And the weight loss is so dramatic, people wonder.
With the Meta System, I've got many questions about how I managed raising a baby and working full-time and lose the weight and eat whatever I wanted.
People who use it recommend it.
I suggested the Meta System to my mother, and she has lost 30 pounds.
Learn more about weight loss with Judy Singer's The Meta System by calling 800-711-JUDY, 800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer, the powerful all-natural way to lose weight, 800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined for an important further drill down on the problems we've been discussing with respect to the efforts of those who adhere to Sharia to impose it on the rest of us. A kind of sanity check, I guess, really, from Europe. Because those who say this sort of thing can't happen in America, our submission to the anti-constitutional regimen that is Sharia, really need only look at what is happening in Europe at the moment to appreciate that that's just not so. I think no one is following this problem as it is, well, metastasizing in Europe more closely than our next guest, Ned May. He is one of the driving forces behind a very important blog on the subject entitled Gates of Vienna. He writes there as Baron Bodice. He is also a now regular contributor to two of my favorite websites, BigPiece.com and FrontPage.com. And he is doing, I think, incalculably important work, keeping book on what is going on in Europe and what it might mean for us if it's not checked there or, worse, allowed to be replicated here. Ned May, thank you for the terrific work you do at Gates of Vienna, and thank you for taking a few minutes with us to talk a little bit about some of the breaking news stories out of Europe in this particular space.
Thank you for having me on, Frank.
Let's start with the very strange, very deeply disturbing case of Elisabeth Sabadich Wolf in Austria. You've been covering this case from the get-go. What's the problem here, and what's the latest?
The latest is that her conviction was upheld for her hate speech conviction. But to go back to the beginning, she was first charged.
Tell us who this woman is, first of all.
Elisabeth Sabadich Wolf is an Austrian activist and a housewife who took up the cause of exposing Islam some years ago and started giving seminars.
But Ned, is it correct to say that she is doing so on the basis of her experience as the daughter of a prominent diplomat in Austria, having spent a lot of time in Muslim society? So it's not just your average housewife. This is a very knowledgeable as well as quite articulate and courageous woman. Am I right?
Absolutely. She was in Iran when she was little during the Iranian Revolution. She was in Kuwait when Kuwait was invaded by Saddam Hussein. And she was in, I think it was Tunisia, when at 9/11, when they danced in the streets after the World Trade Center came down. And she also worked in the embassy in Kuwait. She had a lot of experience, and she's written about it. That's what got her interested in it, especially after she had her daughter and realized what Austria might be like if it kept on importing Muslims at such an astonishing rate. So she started her work then.
And she spoke about, among other things, Muhammad's conduct with a certain young woman, a very young woman at that. And tell us about what she said and what has befallen her as a result of saying it.
She quoted the hadith about Muhammad marrying Aisha when she was 6 and consummating the marriage when it was 9. And she referred to it as Muhammad having a thing for little girls. And that was what she was convicted on. And as a matter of interest,
and again, she was convicted by an Austrian court for doing exactly what? This is a true statement, is it not?
For denigrating the teachings of a legally recognized religion. Islam is legally recognized in Austria as a leftover from the Austro-Hungarian Empire. When Bosnia was included in, I think it was 1912, Bosnia was included in Austria-Hungary. And in order to accommodate all those new Muslims, they made Islam equivalent to the Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church and recognized it as a state religion. So it's protected by the laws, and you cannot denigrate it. It's in the Constitution, if I understand it correctly.
And so she was convicted of having said something against this recognized religion. And just this week, an appeals court ruled on the matter. What was their finding?
They upheld the conviction of the lower court. The judge acknowledged that the hadith in question, which described the consummation of the marriage, was legal to quote because it was public knowledge, but expressing her opinion that Muhammad had a thing for little girls was not legal and was defamatory of Islam. And he upheld the conviction. She has to pay the fine or go to jail.
And so let me make sure I understand this.
One other avenue of appeal.
Ned May, let me just make sure I understand this. The Austrian court found in a free society that it was permissible to essentially say exactly what the Quran or the Hadith in this case describe or prescribe in this matter, basically pedophilia on the part of the founder of the faith, Muhammad, but you may not express an opinion about it? Is that essentially what this comes down to?
Express a value judgment about it is what it comes down to. You may not apply a value judgment to what it says there.
This raises the obvious question that presumably under this stricture, the value judgment of the society, I'm sure this is true in Austria, it's certainly true in this country, and I imagine elsewhere in the West, that pedophilia is an unacceptable activity, would be suddenly seen as no longer acceptable either. I mean, is that the logic of where this takes us, or is it simply that we're going to be driven to a sort of submission to the dictates of Islam in this matter to the extent that our values are at odds with theirs?
Well, we all know that the rules are applied selectively. When Muslims in Austria talk about Jews being apes and pigs or Christians being apes and pigs, nobody prosecutes them. The rules only apply in one direction, just like they do here. Only Christians and native Austrians have to worry about being prosecuted under those laws.
Stunning. And very quickly, we're about to run out of time with you, Ned May. Describe for us something that's happened in the United Kingdom recently that's also very worrying in this regard, as we look at whether these sorts of things might happen here as well.
This happened yesterday. It was a judgment in the court that an illegitimate child that a young Muslim woman had to be put up for adoption, because if the father of the child were to take custody, it would likely cause the father of the girl, the mother of the child, to kill his daughter, the child's grandmother, and all his daughter's siblings. That is, that an honor killing was the likely result of the father having custody of the child, therefore the father couldn't have custody of the child. It was absolute Sharia ruling in a British court.
By a British civil court operating under English common law. Ned May, again, these are just straws in the wind, and you chronicle them.
All over Europe. It's not just
right.
Austria and Britain. It's everywhere in Western Europe.
Right, and you chronicle them faithfully in your blogs at Gates of Vienna and also your pieces at BigPiece.com and FrontPage.com. I hope, despite the tremendous attacks that are leveled against you by those who seek to promote this program of Sharia, that you will continue to do this important work and that you will come back to us with regular updates, as it's vital that we understand this isn't simply conjecture. This is happening. And it can happen here as well. We'll be discussing that in greater detail momentarily with Diana West, one of our country's leading experts on the matter here in the United States, straight ahead.
We want to know what you think here at Secure Freedom Radio. Leave your comments or questions for us at 1-800-332-7131. That's 1-800-332-7131.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey parents, finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, a fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you.
For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
Hi, I'm Drew Brees, NFL quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, here with Bugs Bunny to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you fuel your body and your mind.
So what do you like to throw around the football like Drew?
Skateboard.
Play frisbee in the park.
Ride a bike.
Kick the soccer ball around.
Or dance in your room.
Just move it your way.
Because nothing makes you feel better than moving every day.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
So be a player.
You'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
Move it your way and be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
That's right, at letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
I'm a champion, realize checks mechanism.
Hi, Shaquille O'Neal for Rad. This is not your normal PSA. Don't be stupid. Don't drink and drive. If you're going to go out and have a good time, it's fine. But designate a driver to drive home. Let's stop the madness. Don't drink and drive.
Public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Effney.
We're back, joined for another cut at this problem of the enforcement of Sharia. Not in some abstract way, not someplace else, but here in the United States, with someone who I have come to regard as a truly extraordinary and most insightful observer of this phenomenon. Her name is Diana West. She is a regular guest of ours here at Secure Freedom Radio, I'm very pleased to say, the author of a terrific book, very much relevant to this question, entitled The Death of the Grown-Up, and of countless columns and essays that appear in, most regularly, I guess, her column at the Washington Examiner. And Diana, it's always a pleasure to have you with us. Our very best to you and yours for the season. Give us some glad tidings. Are there any with respect to this question of the kind of Islamization of America that you, as I say, chronicle so closely?
Well, that's a stumper for me to come on with, but I'll give you one in the spirit of the season.
Good.
That when it was revealed that Walter Reed Hospital, the new incarnation, which is the Bethesda Naval Medical Center, I believe it's called, for our wounded military forces, had banned the religious artifacts, including Bibles, as gifts for use by family members in the hospital visiting their wounded. When this was revealed due to some diligent reporting by a Fox Radio reporter, whose name slips my mind at the moment, and taken to the floor of the Congress by Steve King, I believe it was, the rule was said to be rescinded by the chief of staff of the hospital. So maybe that
glimmer,
shows us what people power can do.
Yeah.
A glimmer. So
of
apparently,
goodness.
For visiting the hospital, you may now bring a Bible.
Well, splendid. And I guess this really makes the point that this even had to be contested is suggestive of how bad the rot is. And Diana, we've touched on this in the past, but recap for us, if you will, some of what you have found is going on elsewhere in the military with respect to this kind of, well, I don't know how else to describe it, but submission to the Sharia doctrine.
Yes, well, it needs to be very clear that this is all coming from the counterinsurgency doctrine, that whose central tenet is that we must convince the Muslims in Afghanistan or the Muslims in Iraq or wherever we have forces that we are the good guys and that they should like us. And in order to curry favor in an Islamic culture, there's only one way to do that, and that is to adopt Islamic norms and traditions and practices. And so if you then look back at our history of counterinsurgency, now stretching, these many years, nearly a decade, beginning with Afghanistan, you will see an increasing sensitivity, accommodation, and indeed submission to Islamic law in the military. Going back to the rules that were written for Guantanamo Bay back in, I believe it was 2002, when directives came down that the guards there could not touch a Quran until they had put on clean gloves and only with their right hand and only with this, that, and the other thing. And, you know, just these kinds of very Islamic prohibitions that have only saturated military training. And I'll give you another example, which would be there is a directive right out of the ISAF, which is, of course, our command structure, that stipulates respectful treatment, touching or not touching of the Quran by ISAF soldiers to a point where they must not disrespect it. They must treat it with regard. It is the most unbelievable list of groveling rules.
Dimitude.
It is dimitude, and it exactly parallels the behavior of a non-Muslim subjugated person living under Islamic law.
Which is, of course, a dhimmi. Diana West is our guest, and Diana, you have been, of course, writing on these issues for some time, warning about the counterinsurgency strategy in a number of different respects, not least of which is this business of submission. You've also contributed tremendously to the study that we did at the Center for Security Policy last year entitled Sharia, the Threat to America, which I shamelessly commend to everyone because of the great work that Diana and 18 others did to really help explain what we're up against in this business of Sharia. But quickly, Diana, what is the doctrinal response on the part of those who adhere to this this Sharia program when they perceive such submissive behavior on the part of infidels in particular?
The response of those to whom we're currying favor from?
Yeah, how are they supposed to behave when they see people behaving as dhimmis?
Well, CENTCOM thinks that they should now trust us and do our bidding. But what in fact happens is that this becomes I think of it as the great society with guns. This becomes a gravy train for these various tribal societies and towns and groups to simply beg and plead for more from us and get it because they know that we're weak. It's a very weak stance.
Right.
And
but I wonder whether beg is the right, Diana, I just wonder whether beg is the right word. Yeah, it seems to me that what their response doctrinally is to become even more insistent and arrogant and domineering in order to, as the Quran says, make us feel subdued. And I spoke earlier in the program with Nina Shea about an event that was all about that, it seems to me, and I think to her and probably to you. But let's get your thoughts as well about this conclave that Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, convened at the State Department last week with the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. What did you make of it? And more to the point, what do you think the supremacists, the Islamic supremacists of the OIC made of it?
Well, I think it's one of the great low points in American history that this conclave took place in Washington, D.C. It emerged with a new name, the Istanbul Process, which was new to me, but it, you know, gave it this nice little packaging, nifty little title. But it was an absolute capitulation on the importance, the primary importance of freedom of speech and freedom of conscience, which is not allowed under Islamic law. And even entering into the conversation is indeed a capitulation, because frankly, there is nothing to talk about in terms of these very core issues. But this, in terms of showing the Islamic world, another point of entry, it is a very high point of entry. The Secretary of State of the United States is willing to talk about ways in which to regulate, to coerce, to pressure Americans not express themselves.
To use, as she put it, in this earlier phases of this Istanbul process, in fact, as I recall, in Istanbul itself, to use peer pressure and shaming to impress upon people that they mustn't behave in ways that we abhor. And I guess really, Diana West, as a close observer, in fact, I think the best observer probably in the country of this and monitor of it, to what extent does the mere fact that we have engaged in a conversation is under our Constitution, there shouldn't be anything to talk about, as you say, likely to infringe upon our freedoms, quite apart from what flows from this process, just again, this perception on the part of our enemies that that we're prepared to submit in this way too?
Yes, well, it institutionalizes a process that has been in effect since 9/11, and the importance of it can't be overestimated in the eyes of the world, given the stature of the Secretary of State, no matter who occupies the office. So this was a tremendous defeat for us in terms of our core principles. But again, it was simply, in some ways, you know, guilt, gilding on the lily and icing on the cake, because this process has gone on for so long. And in fact, I was reminded, I've been looking back at some of my covers of Iraq, and I was reminded that very quickly that George Bush, on the 60th anniversary of D-Day, quoted General Eisenhower's very rousing message to the forces and eliminated Eisenhower's reference to the Great Crusade.
Yeah, well, that wouldn't do, would it? As we've discovered. Thank you so much, Diana West, for both the work that you do elsewhere and for joining us time to time. Please come back to us soon, often, in fact, in 2012. And again, the best to you and your family for the holy days and the new year. Next up, we'll be talking with Claire Lopez about a stunning revelation concerning 9/11. You must not miss this. Straight ahead.
I went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medication, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call. And I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the MetaSystem. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The MetaSystem from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a non-profit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home was built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Dennis Prager thinks there should be a simple standard to textbooks.
I'll tell you how I think a textbook should be written. This is what happened. Period.
That is the role of a text.
And if nearly everybody who did something important in American history, if 78.9% of them were WASP males, then I want 78.9% of the textbook to reflect that fact.
I care about truth.
That's why I'm not on the left.
The Dennis Prager Show. Well, good morning and out to food. Weeknights at 10 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org. Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined by Claire Lopez, one of our regular contributors here at Secure Freedom Radio, I'm very pleased to say, also a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy. She served for 20 years as an intelligence officer for the Central Intelligence Agency, is fluent in numerous languages, and is currently continuing to serve her country as a trainer of those out in the shadow world trying to protect us against our enemies. As they emerge, we have a chance to visit with Claire to talk about that, too. Claire, you are the author as well of two books, Appeasing the Ayatollahs and Suppressing Democracy, U.S. Policy and Iranian Opposition, and also What Makes Tehran Tick? Islamist Ideology and Hegemonic Interests. And I want to get right into it with you about Iran, because there's been some important developments recently, and you have been in the thick of them. Tell us about this trial in Manhattan and what it is telling us about the mullahs of Iran and their enmity for this country.
Well, thanks, Frank. It's great to be with you as always. The case that you're talking about is called Havlish, and there is a second case associated with it, which goes by the name of the Bingham case, Bingham et al. Versus the Islamic Republic of Iran, and then the Havlish et al. Versus Islamic Republic of Iran. Both of those filed, as you said, Southern District of New York, and brought by survivors, family members of 9/11 victims. The cases went to a judge, George Daniels, who just last week ruled in those cases and found that Iran and also Hezbollah, it's a terror proxy, were guilty of providing direct and material support to al-Qaeda in the attacks of 9/11. This is really a very significant ruling opens up an entire can of worms about the involvement of Iran now officially judged with al-Qaeda in 9/11.
Yeah. Claire Lopez, let's drill down on this because this is a stunning development in many respects. We've been told endlessly that Sunni Muslims and Shiite Muslims, even if they agree on the necessity of imposing Sharia on the rest of us, are so deeply hostile to one another they couldn't possibly collaborate. And yet what you're saying in this Havlisch case is that a judge found that's exactly what happened. Is that right?
Precisely so. It's difficult to understand how the top-level national security analysts and advisors in the U.S. government can still cling to this fallacy that Sunnis and Shia cannot or would not work together because of ideological reasons. But in the case, the team of lawyers, it's a consortium of eight law firms, actually, under the leadership of Thomas Mellon and out of Philadelphia, and here locally, Tim Fleming, put together evidence. And yes, I co-authored one of the affidavits with friend and colleague Bruce Teft, showed that the alliance between Iran at the top levels of its government and al-Qaeda, or what would become al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, began in Sudan as far back as the early 1990s and proceeded from there.
And so what you've established in your affidavit, what others working with this team of lawyers on behalf of these victims' families, is that, in fact, the Iranian regime has, as Senator Rick Santorum said to us yesterday, not only been at war with us basically since 1979, but that they have been very actively involved in bringing that war to us here on our own soil. Give us a sense of how this evidence was fleshed out beyond your own affidavit, Claire Lopez.
Well, absolutely. Rick Santorum has this precisely correct. All of the information that's contained in these several affidavits, by several, I mean about 10 or 12 of them, actually, including a couple of members of the 9/11 Commission. We have a testimony from Patrick Clausen at the Washington Institute, Judge Jean-Louis Brugier, the French former investigative jurist. Also, importantly, there is testimony, sealed, under seal testimony, 25 hours worth of videotaped testimony from three defectors from the Iranian intelligence service, from the MOIS, that's Ministry of Intelligence and Security. And those three went on the record in testimony that the judge saw about their direct witnessing of Iranian top-level government officials' participation in the planning and direction of the operations for 9/11.
Wow. So there are literally firsthand witnesses to the terror plot who have been instrumental, evidently, in persuading the judge that this case is meritorious. What's the next step, Claire, now that he's provided this this finding? Will the plaintiffs be able to secure justice from Iran?
Well, the immediate next step we're waiting for is the actual publication of the judge's statement and the issuance of his judgment in full, which should take place sometime here during the week of December the 19th. But then it's up to the plaintiffs, really. A number of them are widows. So we call them the widows, seven of them together, to decide, you know, what their next step might be. This does open the possibility that they could, if they wished, sue for financial damages. As your listeners may recall, also just recently, a judge in Washington, D.C. District Court found the country of Sudan, its government leadership, responsible for aiding and abetting al-Qaeda in the 1998 East Africa embassy bombings. So there, too, in a kind of a precedent, is the involvement of Iran and, of course, Hezbollah, and opening that up to whatever the plaintiffs decide. But they have the basis in law now and in this judgment that says that Iran was responsible. So it's up to them to decide how they'll go forward.
And Claire Lopez, as you have spent your life in working against these sorts of enemies, what should the takeaway, in your estimation, be for our government, quite apart from this the case itself and the next steps for the widows? What should our government be doing if now the evidence is, well, at least in the view of this federal judge, unimpeachable, that we are at war with Iran and that war is going to be brought again to our shores if we're not careful, as it has already been in the past?
You know, Frank, that's exactly the right question. The 9/11 Commission report, which you recall came out in the summer of 2004, explicitly touched on this issue of the operational alliance between al-Qaeda and Iran and Hezbollah, too. Based on thousands of documents that the team members had found literally at the very last moment, classified intelligence documents that document the entire history of the al-Qaeda-Iranian operational alliance. The U.S. government has this information. The 9/11 Commission urged them explicitly to follow up on it. It did not, at least to our knowledge, it did not publicly. So the takeaway, if there is any, is that the American people, first of all, have the right to know the truth about what happened at 9/11, and now hopefully they do. But the United States government has the responsibility to hold accountable those who did that act, those who are responsible for that, those heinous attacks on 9/11. And that means holding Iran and its leadership to account, not just going after al-Qaeda, which is well and good, but holding Iran and its political leadership to account. This is separate from the people. The people had nothing to do with this. They hate the regime, and they would like to see it changed. But holding the regime accountable, that's what the United States government owes to the American people, I think.
I couldn't agree with you more, Claire Lopez. And one of the things we try to do here, and often with your help, is to make sure that the American people do understand these realities and can insist that their government act in a manner that is so clearly consistent with their interests and their security needs. Claire Lopez, thanks so much for your insight in this incredibly important matter, for the great work you do at the Center for Security Policy. Merry Christmas to you, and we look forward to talking with you a great deal in the new year. We wish the rest of you the best for the holidays as well, and look forward to talking with you tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.